Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call this meeting of the Human Services Policy Committee to order. Members, if good to have you, please take your seats. We do have a quorum this morning, excuse me, this afternoon. I want to thank everyone for being here. And first of all, I'd also like to hit on a couple things. I want to, first of all, thank everyone for the well wishes and everything with my health scare I had. I will be making a full recovery at all. I appreciate the well wishes. That is one of the things that I know helps in recovery is all the positive energy. So I want to thank everybody for that. We also have had some staffing changes that have occurred. Spencer Kroos is going to be the committee legislative assistant here. On the DFL side, Molly Peterson's going to be doing our research. And then we also have a new page, Florence Awantu in the back there. And then we will still also have Erica helping us out. So these are some of the staffing changes that are happening. So welcome all the new people here that are with us. And then also just kind of want to give folks a little bit of a heads up this year. We are going to be a lot busier, seeing there's not a lot of money out there. This is more the policy year. So I expect us to be a lot busier. Probably at times there may be some extra meetings. Those will probably happen during the same time that Chair Knorr has his committee. So what will happen is that we'll be taking up some of his time if we're finding we've got a lot more policy bills. We're trying to avoid as much as possible coming back in the evenings, trying to keep those free for people. So, and we will stay in touch with everybody on both sides to make sure we know what's happening. But we do expect a lot of things coming forward. I know we're going to have a lot happening in the mental health area, addiction areas. I know there's a lot of different bills that are going to be moving. I know we've got work that will be happening in the assisted living area. There's going to be some clarifications in there. And I also know there's a lot of disability bills that are going to be moving that we'll be hearing. So we're going to have a busy year, but I also see a lot of common ground that will be happening between us all to get the right things done to help out Minnesotans. So I'm looking forward to a good year. Thank you, everyone, for being here. And with that, we will move to the first item, our next action item on the agenda. That's going to be the approval of the minutes. We've got several sets of minutes from our last few meetings. First of all, we have the minutes from our final hearing in our 2023 legislative session, which was on March 15th. We also had our off-site hearing in Moorhead on October 16th, and we had an informal hearing on January 24th. And so I'm wondering if there's somebody who'd like to make a motion to approve all 3 minutes.
So move the minutes.
Chair Knorr moves approval of the minutes from March 15th, 2023, October 16th, 2023, and January 24th, 2024. Any questions or amendments? Hearing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes as presented signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries and the minutes are adopted. Our first item that we have on the agenda is a bill that I am presenting, so I'm going to be turning the gavel over to Representative Frederick.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Would you like to bring your bill before the committee?
Yes, I would. I'd like to move to lay House File 3495 over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand that you also have an author's amendment.
Yes, if I could move the author, the A2 author's amendment, and this is to get the bill into the shape that I would like. There's been a lot of ongoing discussion that has occurred after the base bill was involved, and so this is getting the new language added on, and we will explain it all as we take up the main bill.
Do any committee members have any questions about regarding the A2 author's amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. Chair Fisher, to your bill.
Thank you very much, Chair Frederick. And committee, thank you for the opportunity to present the bill today, 3495. This is a bill that's going to be addressing a lot of updating of what needs to happen in the mental health space. At this moment, we have increasing access to mental health care, and it's critical for our state, and we must take steps to help streamline regulations, adapt to meet current workforce environment, address service access barriers, and support mental health to focus on their efforts as much as possible on quality treatment. And we've been doing this process over several years. 2 years ago, we came forward with a start of a uniform standards bill to pull things into shape to help make things more efficient out there, make sure people are able to get the care that they need, and help reduce paperwork that's really not needed in the process. And that was very successful, and this is a continuation of what was started several years ago. This is not going to be a complete change of everything, because there's so many other statutes out there and continuing work that happens with the providers out there and with DHS. To that end, paired with efforts to help fix Medicaid reimbursements, I'm bringing this bill before you today, centered on policy-focused improvements we can make to our mental health system. This bill is focused on modernizing our mental health services regulation to increase access to services and to allow mental health service staff to focus on quality service delivery. This will lessen the barriers clients face in accessing care and allow providers to focus on care delivery to clients and communities. The bill before you today represents many months of work that mental health stakeholders collectively have worked together across the Mental Health Legislative Network and other partners to identify specific areas in statute we can update regulations to advance the goal of increasing access and place the highest value on use of staff time. The bill language has been shared with DHS, and we will continue to work with DHS for their technical assistance, as this is very important as we move forward. I know that some of you are in conversations about joining as co-authors, and I thank you for that. And I would ask committee members for the support of this bill, particularly as these are practical policy changes intended to help address the ongoing crisis that we face. This will also become a basis for a, and this is one of the reasons we're laying it over, as a basis for a larger mental health bill, policy bill that will be going forward that may eventually go to the health committee. Part of it is we're also laying it over because we want to make sure that there are no costs in here. One of the things that we have requested is a fiscal note to make sure that is the situation. If there are fiscal costs in here, we would break that out separately at a certain point. So these are the steps that we're taking to make sure that we have a good policy bill. If there's any costs related, making sure that we've got that separate to deal with and sent to the appropriate committees. At this point in time, I've got a couple of testifiers with me who will help explain the bill, and I would like to invite them up at this point in time.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. Up to testify first will be Annie Simons from the Mental Health Providers Association of Minnesota. Please make your way to the testifier table, introduce yourself for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Frederick, members of the committee. My name is Ani Simons, and I am representing the Mental Health Providers Association of Minnesota, or MHPAM. MHPAM is one of the multiple groups that contributed some of the policy proposals for this collaborative legislation. I'm going to briefly walk through the eight sections of the bill. I'm then going to turn it over to Ms. Anderson, who will walk through the sections of the amendment. We then have two mental health service providers here today to testify to further speak to the bill, and we're happy to take any questions and have issue experts available to help speak to the sections if needed. So with that, I will move into a brief walkthrough of the bill contents. Section 1 relates to the use of functional assessments and allows for the option of a provider using validated measurement tools when completing a functional assessment, as well as removes the narrative requirement under a functional assessment. Section 2 creates a narrow exemption to address a barrier to care that was created with a new Uniform Service Standards nursing oversight requirement within children's day treatment. Section 3 of the bill removes Rule 29 requirements for mental health professionals to have specialization in two different mental health disciplines. Section 4 of the bill proposes an alternate two-part requirement to address the on-the-ground challenges that exist with meeting the current intensive residential treatment services requirements for a weekly in-person treatment team meeting with all treatment team members. Section 5 of the bill requires DHS clarity and standardization in provider entity certification criteria. Section 6 of the bill updates Children's Therapeutic Services and Support Statute to reflect uniform service standards regarding timing of diagnostic assessments and allows access to Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports through a brief diagnostic assessment. Section 7 of the bill allows for children's therapeutic services and support services to be concurrently provided to a child and caregiver who are receiving two separate services at the same time. And Section 8 of the bill changes the licensed alcohol and drug counselor requirement for intensive rehabilitative mental health services to instead align with the assertive community treatment requirement of a co-occurring disorder specialist who has received specific training on co-occurring disorders. And with that, I will turn it back over to the chair for the next testifier.
Thank you, Ms. Simmons. Up next will be Kirsten Anderson, Executive Director from Aspire, Minnesota. Please make your way to the testifier table, state your name for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Frederick and committee members. My name is Kirsten Anderson. I'm with Aspire, Minnesota, and here to walk through the amendment. The following sections provide licensing updates for children's residential care by shifting language from Rule 2960 to statute, focusing on supervision, medication administration, and training requirements. The first five sections establish definitions for children's residential care with references from existing definitions in the Children's Mental Health Act and Uniform Service Standards. The next section establishes licensing certification for children's residential mental health treatment. The next section outlines supervision standards for children's residential mental health treatment. The next section describes requirements for administration of psychotropic medications in this setting. The next section outlines training requirements for delivering care to children and services defined by the Rule 2960, with the exception of foster care providers and foster residences. The next two sections update 245I to be consistent with the changes passed in 2023 that eliminate statutory requirements regarding the use of specific assessment tools with children and updates requirements for the functional assessment required update to annual cadence. The next section proposes including an existing code from armed services to apply within children's therapeutic services and supports to support aftercare for children when transitioning to the community after intensive residential mental health care. The next section includes transition to the community living services to CTSS services. The next section directs the Commissioner of Human Services to conduct rulemaking that updates Rule 2960 to reflect the training requirements preserved in the rule that outline training requirements for foster providers and foster residences. The final section repeals the sections of 2960 that are updated in this proposal. And I'll turn back over to Chair Fisher for the testifiers.
Chair Fisher.
Thank you. That is the presentation of the bill. And then I do know that we have a couple of testifiers for why we need to have the changes. So if we could have our testifiers come forward, if you'd like to call them, Chair Frederick.
First up, we will have Uwe Yang, Vice President of Community Health and Wellness from the Wilder Foundation. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, Pahua Yang. And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of this bill. I especially feel honored to be here because 2024 marks our work in the mental health space for 100 years. So my name, as I said before, is Pahua Yang. I am the Vice President of Community Mental Health and Wellness at the Wilder Foundation in St. Paul. And while I represent Wilder, I want to be very clear that I sit here also representing the many voices of providers and communities across the state. As a community mental health clinic and a certified community behavioral health clinic, Wilder provides a spectrum of mental health and substance use disorder services to our communities. We strive to serve our community holistically through a one-stop shop method of practice. We operate this way because we know that comprehensive and holistic service methods are the most effective at improving health outcomes for both the individual and societal levels. Despite Minnesota's talented, passionate, and intelligent provider network, severe and coinciding crises challenge our mental health and SUD treatment services. The ongoing workforce crisis, chronic underinvestment, and convoluted regulation system that creates and reinforces silos rather than bringing services together under consistent requirements are limiting our ability to serve the needs of Minnesotans. We know people don't come to us as a separate set of symptoms, and we're working to build our programs in order to respond to their needs. This legislation provides many proposals that allow community mental health clinics, such as Wilder, to keep moving forward toward an integrated, holistic model of care. It furthers efforts to streamline regulations that govern a set of services we are working to bring together. And we can only be as integrated as the rules that govern our work allow us to be. By bringing these services together, we will be able to increase access to our community by removing entry barriers, support our staff and programs by flexibly responding to persistent capacity constraints, support clinics' compliance with regulations by bringing some consistency to them, allow our programs to better operate in this post-COVID environment, accessing technology solutions in the same way other fields are doing, and finally, allow our clinicians to work at the top of their licenses and really focus on providing good care to our clients in our communities. I want to acknowledge the good work that this legislature and the Department of Human Services have started in bringing our mental health regulations together in one statute, along with the steps that you've taken to streamline them. Clinics like Wilder and our many colleagues across the state are committed to continuing to work with you, the department, and our community partners to build a better, more effective system for our community, for the way mental health and SUD treatment and care should be delivered now and into the future. We know that this bill is the next step in building a regulatory system with guardrails and the flexibility that allows us to respond to the changing needs of our service community. Thank you for your leadership and support.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Next up will be James Neese, Director of Compliance from Volunteers of America, Minnesota and Wisconsin.
Thank you. You're one of the first to get that right.
Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thanks, sir. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is James Neese. I am the Director of Compliance with Volunteers of America, Minnesota, Wisconsin. Prior to joining Volunteers of America, I was a senior licensor for the Minnesota Department of Human Services, and I have been a direct service provider in several residential and community-based service programs for children. This legislation provides important updates throughout our mental health service continuum. For children's residential care, we propose to use an existing service code to deliver aftercare for children transitioning to community following intensive treatment. It is of critical importance to support the child and family to sustain the benefit of treatment as they integrate into community life. We also propose revisions to licensing standards because the current standards regulating the Department of Human Services and the Department of Corrections Children's Residential Facilities, which is Administrative Rule 2960, does not effectively meet the needs of the children served and is a challenge to comprehend for many licensed providers. Volunteers of America and other providers that oversee residential care for children with diverse and complex needs can attest that operating under the authority of a set of standards that are antiquated and inconsistent does a disservice to the valuable care and treatment we are providing to children and families. Services currently licensed under CRF Rule 2960 are extremely diverse, and providers are too often impeded by this rule as it does not reflect current best practices and services. This proposal provides a starting point to incorporate language from the rule into statute in anticipation of bringing future proposals that will continue this work, as has been reflected in other projects before this committee, to bring all relevant pieces of CRF Rule 2960 into statute, and with your leadership, we can sustain oversight and adjust language as needed for these critical services. Provider experts came together to identify areas of CRF Rule 2960 that are the most cumbersome and unclear. Today's proposal reflects updates in supervision of treatment and services, psychotropic medication administration, and employee training. We believe the revisions advance the goal of articulating quality standards for children's residential care. We look forward to continuing to work with the Department of Human Services on this language and sustaining this important reform effort to achieve clarity as we provide critical services to children in Minnesota who require residential treatment services. Thank you for your leadership and your support.
Thank you for your testimony. At this point, that's all I have for people that have signed up to testify. Is there anyone from the public that would like to come forward and testify to this bill? All right, we will turn it over at this point to member questions. Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. My question there, can you explain the changes to the RN oversight of the medications for children who self-administer the medication? Because there's that change in there. Most, I understand, please correct me wrong, that most of those facilities already have an RN, Adam.
Chair Fisher.
And I'll call my supporter up here. Is from my recall, part of it is, if I remember right, this is the one that deals with the self-administration where they already, where the child themselves are already able to self-medicate, and the way the rules are right now does not allow them to do that. And these are situations where they'd be able to self-medicate in other situations. So we're just trying to make that process easier. And I'll turn over my testifier to see if there's anything she'd like to add on that.
Ms. Anderson.
Chair Frederick and Representative Backer. Yeah. It's true that in our children's day treatment settings, they don't typically have RN oversight for their activities. And so once 245I Uniform Service Standards came into being and required that, that really prevented the services from being able to administer medications. And so those children were disallowed from participating in care. And as you know, when we disallow access to intensive levels of care, that oftentimes prompts need for more intensive care. And so we're trying to make a prudent proposal here that suggests when a child is capable of self-administering their inhaler, their insulin, and their prescriber is able to attest to that and attest to that to the day treatment setting, that should be allowed.
Representative Backer, any follow-up?
Yeah, so if I'm understanding you correctly, before they would get the medication, there would be procedures, and this may be already happening that I'm not aware, there'll be procedures in place to make sure it's the right medicine at the right dose at the right time.
Ms. Anderson.
Chair Frederick, Representative Backer, that is the responsibility of the prescriber, and it's simply being sustained in daily life and in day treatment as in daily life.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Representative Adelson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for this bill. I actually want to refer to the amendment. If you could go to subdivision, line 7.12, I want to understand a little bit more of a picture of what this is going to look like. So you're in children's residential care. For this language, correct? So refusal of routine administration of the psychotropic medication, if the family has decided that they don't want medication of the child and they have come to this agreement, give me some examples of alternatives.
Ms. Anderson.
Chair Frederick, can I invite the testifier to speak to that question? Yeah. Mr. Neese.
Phone a friend.
Team effort. Mr. Neese.
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Allison.
Mr. Neese, so I want to better understand, because it's really hard for kids to get care right now, right? Especially in children's, I mean, we just don't have enough children's residential care. We need more. And so I'm just trying to understand, and I understand this would be a very troubling, I mean, as somebody that as a clinician myself, it's hard if you're not going to take the medication and we've deemed it necessary. So I just am kind of curious what this actually looks like in play. It's language on a paper, but I just, in terms of the staff in that building and the child and the family, tell me what that actually looks like. I'm just curious what the alternatives are.
Mr. Neese.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. In the facility, if you're, I just want to be clear. So this is if the child is refusing, the medication, or the family refuses the medication, correct?
That's correct. And so if it's a refusal of routine medication.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that would be primarily up to the decision of the prescriber. If this is something that would inhibit, if this is something that they require as a part of the treatment, then they would have that conversation with the family. If they refuse to take them, to say, on a daily basis or one day, it's really more of just a documentation of the refusal. If it is not going to prohibit their care or the mental health services or improve, you know, have a real negative impact on their treatment, then it would just be a note in a file, and they would move on.
Representative Edelson, follow up.
Mr. Chair, if you could just follow up after outside of this meeting with me, I want to talk with you about this whole section.
Sure.
Thank you.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair. If the testifier would maybe just stay, and I might need Ms. Anderson as well. When we're talking about that particular section, right now, if a child, a teenager, is refusing their medications, are they sometimes being released from a program?
Well, I can't speak in all cases. Generally, no, they'll find some other alternative. Again, unless that decision is up to a prescriber, the prescriber themselves, if they say, I can't treat this child anymore unless the medication is there, then other alternatives would have to be looked at. But in my experience, it's really quite rare, one, that they refuse the medication more than, I guess, as a kind of a power struggle versus really having a strong stance against that. But it would be rare that a child would be actually discharged simply because of not taking a medication.
Thank you so much for that clarification.
Any other follow-up? Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Seeing no further discussion, Chair Fisher, any closing comments?
I want to say thank you for the questions. This is a bill that we are going to continue to work on. Representative Edelson, I look forward to connecting with you. We are also looking forward to the continued input from the department, and we will be bringing this back in the future as part of a larger package. And with that, I renew my motion that House File 3495 as amended be laid over for further consideration.
House File 3495 as amended is laid over.
Thank you, Vice Chair Frederick, for running the meeting. Our next item is a presentation from the Department of Human Services previewing their policy bills that will be coming before the committee as they are jacketed. I'd like to welcome to the committee Director Briones and Director Graham. Please introduce yourself. Oh, I also see we've got an additional person up there. So why don't we do this? Who's ever going to start first, introduce yourselves. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair and members. My name is Carrie Briones. I'm the Legislative Director for Direct Care and Treatment at the Department of Human Services.
I'm Jacqueline Sammons. I'm a registered nurse, the nurse executive of the Mental Health Substance Abuse Treatment Services Division of Direct Care and Treatment.
Okay, very good. Well, thank you for being here. And Director Briones, you'll start first then.
Sure. I'm here to thank you again, Chair and members. I'm here today to provide an overview of the forthcoming policy bill out of Direct Care and Treatment. It's a pretty short bill. There's only two components to it. The first section is related to bloodborne pathogen testing in our non-secure portions of Direct Care and Treatment facilities. Currently, our secure settings within Direct Care and Treatment are able to obtain a court order to require patients to submit to bloodborne pathogen tests following a significant exposure to a patient. This proposal will give non-secure Direct Care and Treatment facilities the same authority. For example, in facilities such as our regional psychiatric hospitals, vocational programs, residential group homes, and other residential mental health treatment programs. Following a significant exposure, if a patient does not submit to a bloodborne pathogen test, staff in non-secure facilities that experience a potential exposure are not able to make fully informed decisions regarding their personal health care decisions. Conditions such as hepatitis B and C, HIV, and other chronic conditions are life-altering and require lifetime care. There are health risks associated with obtaining treatment, but also with not obtaining treatment. This change will give staff at all DCT facilities the same level of protection and peace of mind. The incidence of client and patient refusal to test for bloodborne pathogens and direct care and treatment seeking a court order is low. Insecure facilities is low. Most clients and patients agree to be tested, but a court order is needed in the rare occasions they do not. Direct care and treatment does not anticipate a significant increase in court orders requiring bloodborne pathogen testing, but we want to make sure that we have this tool available to safeguard the health of our staff when this is necessary. Direct care and treatment has reached out to stakeholders and advocates and has not received any opposition to this proposal. I will move on to the second half, if that's okay. Okay. The second part of the policy bill is a technical change and fixes an incorrectly listed member of the Priority Admissions Task Force. When the statute creating the task force was created last session, the Minnesota Civil Commitment Defense Panel was listed in the language, and there is no organization in the state of Minnesota operating under that name. Based on the organizations operating in the state of Minnesota, DHS interpreted this appointing authority to mean the Hennepin County Commitment Defense Project. This error was not identified until the appointment process, and the Secretary of State recommended amending the language to reflect accurate membership. A member representing the Hennepin County Commitment Defense Project is on the task force. And so in summary, what this proposal will do was we'll switch out the names to reflect the current membership. I'll stand for questions if anybody has any.
Are there any questions? Not seeing any, let's move on to the next segment. And this here is Director Christy Grom coming up. If you'd like to introduce yourself and begin your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Christy Grom, and I'm with the Department of Human Services. So in my area of the department, which is covers behavioral health, housing, deaf and hard of hearing, and disability services, as well as now complex care transitions. We'll have several policy bills, several provisions in our policy bill, and they fall into jurisdictions that are in different committees. So we're gonna have two kind of main policy bills. So I'll walk through the first one to begin with. It has six major provisions. And then I'll walk through the second one. And I believe you all have a handout in your packets that provides a summary so that you can take a deeper dive into what I'm talking about. And we are just awaiting bill language from the reviser. It should be this week, I'm told. So hopefully we can get that out to the committee as soon as possible so you can really dig into it and let us know if you have questions or concerns. So the first proposal is related to some of our disability services forms. So we have a couple of forms that we're having issues where there's a variety of variations of these forms being used by providers and by counties, which is creating a lot of confusion. In some cases, it's creating a lot of extra work for providers. And so the forms that I'm referring to in particular are related to DWRS, the Disability Waiver Rate System. For those in the business, this is the 6790 form. So it's the form that providers need to fill out based on a person's support plan that really explains the services that the person is eligible for and is authorized to receive. So it's a really critical document. It's not one of those that we can just remove, although we do try to simplify whenever possible, because it really establishes the foundation for our prospective-based rate methodology, which is approved by CMS. And we've got counties that are, several counties have their own forms and they've added different fields and it's just creating a lot of confusion. So this proposal would say the commissioner, you must use the commissioner's form. I will say we're in the process of meeting with counties to really inquire, hey, why are you adding these extra fields, and what can we do to make sure that the form that we're going to require is meeting your needs in your local community. Similar to that, we have a form for service terminations under 245D, and this is a form that a provider would fill out when they're going to terminate someone's services, and I believe also suspend their services, which is a more short-term action. And it's really important that DHS gets those forms, that we understand what the situation is when someone is being terminated. So we want to make sure, number one, the termination complies with law, that the person had appropriate notice, mm-hmm. that there aren't possibilities for that person to stay in that setting. And number two, we want to make sure that we're engaging with the person's support team so that they can find the place that works better for that person. So here again, we're getting just a variety of forms, and it's creating some workflow issues. So we would just really like to simplify and require that all providers use the same form that we'll share with the community. The next proposal is related to the Personal Care Assistance Program, or Community First Services and Supports, which will be the new PCA program. And this proposal is pretty simple. It's similar to some work that the legislature did a couple of years ago for disability waiver services. And it would allow for MnChoice's reassessments to occur remotely for PCA. So right now that's allowed under waiver services, but not for PCA. So it's really just common sense change to align with waiver services, and there are some parameters in place that ensure that the person chooses a remote assessment, and I believe that it's only offered every other reassessment, so there are still some face-to-face reassessments in there as well. The next provision I won't dwell on a whole lot, but it's related to our technology first policy. So this is a policy that the legislature codified in, I believe it was 2021, and then there were some revisions to it the year after. And it's a variety of policy statements that related to independent living, related to employment first, as well as technology first concepts. And in each of those areas of law, it's, when you see the bill, you'll see what I mean. There is a provision that essentially says it's the policy of the state that all adults who want to access technology or services via technology, via remote services, that they're able to do that. And this particular section is just missing a sentence that says that the individual will be offered assistive technology or remote services prior to being offered traditional services. And the point of these is that these are policy statements, so they're not necessarily something that would be regulatory in nature, but those policy statements are really there to help encourage counties, encourage lead agencies to not take the default all the time. So not say, think in their head automatically that someone is definitely going to have to go to a group home when they might do better in another setting, or they automatically need in-person services when assistive technology might be appropriate. The next provision is related to minimum wage protections for people with disabilities. So this is a topic that this committee has explored last year, and there were several provisions that the legislature passed and funded, which was excellent, to help providers and to help families and people transition to more competitive integrated employment. The only piece of that proposal that didn't pass last year, unfortunately, was the piece that would phase out the use of what are called subminimum wages. So that's an allowance under the Fair Labor Standards Act that's quite antiquated, I think back to 1938, and it allows people with disabilities to be paid less than the minimum wage. And so this proposal would just say people with disabilities can get a minimum wage. We're not taking anything away. People still have day services that they can go to. And there's a lot of supports for providers who are wanting to transition to a more competitive integrated model. If they don't, they don't necessarily have to. They just need to offer minimum wage. The next proposal in this, the first package of bills, is related to our Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services Act. So this is a proposal that's really just going to do some modernization, some updates. This act hasn't been updated in about a decade or so. So there's some minor kind of amendments to the duties and responsibilities of the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services Division, which is housed in DHS. There's also a name change, so we will be, or if the legislature agrees and enacts this language, we would be proposing to add deafblind to the name of the division to really make sure that we're supporting that community as well. And then there's some changes around just more modernized language. So we talk about, and you may have heard of, you know, culturally specific or culturally affirmative. We wanted to add some language in this area of law related to linguistically affirmative services. And then lastly, there are some technical changes in this provision as well. And so we've met with the State Services for the Blind, the Minnesota Council on Disability, Commission on Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing. And we have integrated their suggestions into this language. And then the last kind of big chunk of policy changes in this provision is related to substance use disorder primarily. There were a lot of really wonderful changes last session, innovative changes that will really have the potential to impact people's lives for the better. And so we were really happy about that, but there was a lot of moving pieces. So with passing the requirements related to transitioning to ASAM, American Society of Addiction Medicine, direct access, many other changes, there's just a lot of things we need to clean up. And some of those provisions passed in a policy bill, some of them passed in a budget bill, and we were amending the same section. So that's why there's a lot of SUD cleanup, just for some background. But we've got a few things like cross-reference cleanup. There was essentially a cross-reference removed that would remove a rate enhancement. That was not the intent. There was no funding for that. We're looking at making some changes for a provider, one that we know of in the state, at least one, maybe there's more, that provides a 3.7 level of care. So this is medically monitored withdrawal management. And so this provider, because the 3.7 level of care isn't in statute yet, it's a new kind of level of care that we haven't added for under ASAM. They are having to enroll in the demonstration as a different level of care, which creates issues for their other payers, so their managed care, their commercial payers. So this provision would provide a sort of extension for this particular provider. It's a really important service. We don't have many of them in Minnesota. To be able to enroll in the demonstration, instead of this past January, it would be next January when the outpatient providers enroll, at which point they would be able to enroll at the correct level of care. We've got some definitions that got kind of mixed up and where we didn't, we were making changes in definitions and we didn't update all of the right sections, so we're gonna do that in these provisions. We have a few clarifications related to comprehensive assessment, so that's the assessment that people get when they are accessing or wanting to access substance use disorder services. So it could be clinical services, could be peer services. So we're in this bill really providing clarification on the differences between a comp assessment when it's conducted within a licensed treatment program, where there are different requirements, as you might imagine, and when, you know, because they have licensing guidelines that they have to follow, and when the assessment is conducted outside of a licensed program, when those when certain timelines might not apply. And I think the last thing I'll just mention quickly, just some corrections just to be aware of. The Association for Recovery Community Organizations changed its name, so we need to do that in statute. And there was a few other corrections that we're just making sure to clean up the law, making sure we have clear authority that providers understand expectations. And I promise the next chunk of the next bill is shorter. But I would stand for questions if you wish to share.
Certainly. Thank you. Thank you for the presentation on the first part. Are there any questions in these first ones? And this will also be a bill that will be coming for before us at a certain point. But are there any questions or concerns at this point? Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Chair. Ms. Crom, I heard you talking about CFSS and MinChoices and the remote piece for PCA, which I think is great. Is there any other changes in the bill anywhere around MinChoices, frequency, or anything of that nature?
Director Graham.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, not in this bill. Those are ideas and discussions that we've been having with community. So, for example, one of the big, I think very popular ideas that we have been talking about, we don't know if it will come forward in a bill through the governor's office or not, would be changing some of the timelines related to the initial MIN choices assessment, keeping that initial assessment open for up to a year instead of, I believe it's 90 days right now. And what's happening is those assessments are timing out, as you might know, and it's making people at times have to jump through hoops and do three assessments, and that makes no sense. We do not want to do that to people. That's not the goal here. So that's one of the ideas we've talked about. I know other organizations have had ideas about, you know, changing the reassessment, maybe shortening it, maybe streamlining it. So those are conversations that we anticipate will be had as we really head into session and talk more about budget issues.
Okay. Representative Hicks, any other questions?
No, thank you, Chair. Just I've heard from our counties, and so I just wanted to bring the discussion up while we were early in session.
Certainly appreciate that. Any other questions or comments on this part? Hearing none, Director Graham, if you'd like to move on to what's going to be the second bill.
Okay, so the second bill, so this would be sort of the mental health and housing jurisdictions part of our bill. The first provision, the first of three, is related to some just technical changes under the adult income programs under general assistance. So the first change is related to just an error in an effective date last session. So there are last session, for those that, just for a refresher, a lot happened. The legislature increased general assistance from $203 a month to $350. That was effective October 2024. It was an amazing reform, and we are so excited that amount hasn't been changed since 1986. It's also now tied to inflation. But there was a couple, there's a couple different sections in that area of law describing populations that are on general assistance, and one of those effective dates was incorrect. It said October 2023, which just doesn't align with the spreadsheet. And so we're just fixing that effective date. And then the second part of this proposal is there are three sections of law in the general assistance program statute that are obsolete. They're related to the poor relief program. One of the things I love about this job, and I think others will agree, is that you learn something new every day. So for those who don't know what the poor relief program was back in the day, I would encourage you to look into it, but essentially this was a system that I think started around the Civil War, where before we had the kinds of economic supports that we have right now, people would essentially be auctioned off if they had a disability, if they had a mental health issue, if they were widowed. If they were an orphan sometimes, if they were what was called back then a pauper, and counties would run farms and people would go, there would be advertisements and counties would say, someone would say, we'll pay you to take this person. And then they would go to the farm and then they would basically be indentured servants. So that's what our system looked like before we had economic assistance. I just think it's interesting to understand where we came from. Anyways, there's a bunch of obsolete provisions in general assistance that relate to that poor relief program that we're getting rid of as part of this bill. The next part is related to housing support. The first clarification here is just making sure that the housing support requirements align with the housing support contracts that counties have. So there's essentially a place in law that says, you know, everyone needs to meet certain requirements if you're licensed and registered, but then there's exemptions from licensure and registration for certain settings. And so we're just sort of cleaning it up and making sure that everyone needs to meet the housing support standards. And then next, related to that, housing support is essentially funded in two ways, either through direct payments to a vendor or a provider on behalf of a specific individual, or through a lump sum payment to a lead agency that represents an estimated expenditure over a period of time for a program to serve a variety of people. And so this is an option. It's called a cost neutral transfer, and it's an option that a lot of times emergency shelters choose because they have such a transient population that they serve, and it just makes more sense for them. But we have two areas of law where the requirements for cost neutral transfers are spelled out, and they're both different, and it's causing a lot of confusion. So this provision just consolidates all of those requirements in one place and makes the expectations clear for providers. And then lastly, we do have a couple of changes related to the behavioral health home service. So for those that don't know, behavioral health home is a newer service. It was something that was authorized under the Affordable Care Act. And I believe we implemented it here in Minnesota in 2016. So this is a service that really helps support people who have chronic health conditions, who have mental illness, children with emotional disturbance. And it's essentially a team-based model where people are supported across primary care, substance use disorder, mental health, long-term services and supports. So it's a really important evidence-based model here in Minnesota. And a couple of things, a couple of tweaks that we're looking to make from a policy lens is there is a requirement that the provider obtain written consent before delivering the services in statute. And that is something that we've changed in a lot of our services. It was a learning from the pandemic. And so we'd like to do it here as well to make sure that we're promoting more person-centered engagement and that people aren't running around trying to get someone's signature when they indeed have consented. And so this would just allow consent telephonically or electronically. And then lastly, both of these are actually from the provider community requests that we've had that we agree with. Providers are required right now to complete a specific or to utilize data from a specific portal called the Human Services Partner Portal to help them work with clients across different provider types and identify past and current treatment services. We've been told there's a lag in that data. It's not really helpful for providers. It's based off of claims data, which is why there's a lag. So we're just going to not be as specific and just say that they can use a tool identified by the commissioner, and we've got some ideas on what those might be. And that is my presentation, Mr. Chair and members. Happy to answer questions.
Okay, thank you. Any questions on the second section as presented? Chair Knorr?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for the information, Ms. Rob. I've got a question about the housing support model. I know you talked about the two different ways it's being administered. Some of the agencies usually don't provide that service to everyone, so it's more based of who's the lead entity. Are we able to walk away from lead entity based on those individuals who are eligible for the program to get the services that they need?
Director Graham.
Mr. Chair, Chair Knorr, I think that that's a conversation that we're going to be discussing this session. I know that there are several providers, especially some culturally specific providers, who are encountering situations where counties are not allowing them, they're not opening up housing support agreements with them, which is concerning to us. We understand that housing support is a unique economic. Sorry.
Dr. Graham, go ahead.
I was like, oh, did I say something wrong? Someone's correcting me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's a unique economic assistance program compared to like some others, for example, like MFIP or general assistance, where you just determine eligibility and someone gets it. Counties do play a significant role in overseeing housing support. So I think, you know, conversations around expanding access would be really welcomed by the department. But I also think we want to make sure that we're supporting counties with some of their administrative expenses. So I think there's a way to get there, but it's an ongoing discussion that we're looking forward to having.
Chair Knorr.
Mr. Chair, I look forward to having that conversation, so because it impacts some of the programs that under the jurisdiction of this committee and the finance one. So we look forward to seeing the proposal. Thank you.
All right. Any other comments or questions for Director Graham? Hearing none, thank you so much for the presentation. And our final presentation today is going to be on the update on the transition of the direct care and treatment program from the Department of Human Services. We have Executive Director Storkamp. Welcome to the committee. If you'd like to please introduce yourself and proceed with your presentation. And there's also should be a copy of the presentation in our packets.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, I'm Dan Storkamp, Director of Operations for care and treatment, also the incident commander for the DCT creation project. Our executive director, our CEO, Marshall Smith, asked me to come present to you today kind of where we're at in this, and he looks forward to working with you and the group as we kind of move forward on things. Just as a reminder, last session you passed the Chapter 61, which actually created the Department of Direct Care and Treatment. It requires the department to report to a board and not to, a commissioner. It requires legislation that you brought forward this session, talking about what that board should consist of. It also provides protections for employees as they transfer from one agency to the other, and had an effective date of January 1 of 2025. When I do these presentations, I really like giving kind of what's the reason. Why did we separate even to begin with? Direct care and treatment is a treatment providing program. And by having this separated, we actually have got healthcare professionals that lead our organization through that board. We provide this clear distinction between DCT, who's a treatment provider, and what DHS does for payments, regulation, and policy. We preserve and reinforce that whole clinical judgment, not only from the top, but all the way through the process as we are taking care of patients and managing patients. We also can advocate with our partners to DHS on the whole continuum of the care that is needed in all the areas, CD, sex offender, and mental health. And DCT is more agile and able to make speedier decisions. This is something we looked at during COVID in particular. And being a healthcare organization in a government setting, we needed that quick decisions about masks or providing us with the vaccines and that type of process. This just depicts the three different areas that are working on different things. So you've heard that DCYF has an implementation office that was created from the legislature. MMB has 10 staff there that are actually creating this new agency for DCYF. We created an incident command team. This is something we used during COVID. For the 3 years, had an incident command team in that process that could make quick decisions, could move things up the chain, as well as make sure that we get information communicated out more centrally in that process. So we're following that same process here. So while DCYF is creating DCYF, the implementation office is creating DCT, and then we're both aligning and coordinating with DHS as we kind of separate and kind of move forward the things. One of the key things that we're looking at as moving forward is that DCT already has many of our staff assigned to DCT and coming out of our budget. Matter of fact, 98% of our budget is already assigned to direct FTEs that are DCT specific. We work closely with DHS on a service level agreement for about 2%. I'll describe which areas in a moment. But even within that 2%, DHS has people assigned to DCT specific. So when we separate, we really got a small piece of separation that we're working really close, which makes DCT more aligning and coordinating with DHS and DCYF as we move forward. I mentioned the areas. We got core service areas at the top, five of our core divisions that we provide direct care treatment to. That, of course, is within the DCT budget. The support services, everything in blue is currently within our budget. It's the green areas that DHS has been providing for DHS or for DCT over the last several years. And that's what we're working with them and coordinating on how to separate that out and aligning with both the DCYF and DHS direction. Part of the legislation last year was that January 1, we become our own agency. I would propose, and we're proposing back to legislature, that we'd like to push that to July 1 of 25 for three reasons. First, I think this group is very aware of our biennial budget. And to transfer in the middle of a budget just creates a lot of unnecessary components that we could utilize during the both upcoming legislative session on budget as well as the MMB's system to put in place for fiscal year 26 and 27. Secondly, our union contracts end June 30th of 2025. So it'd be nice starting out a new agency with new contracts with all of our unions and all the supplementals specific to DCT. And third, I'll be talking about the revisers bill in a moment, but there's a revisers bill that's going to be coming out that moves DCT language into the new chapter. And I think you may look at that saying it's a very large bill, and our partners in DCT may need more time to review that in that process. That gives us another session to come back to make any adjustments if need be. As DCT looks at the whole transition process, we took it as a very internal component and said there are three waves that we want to approach here. First wave is those items that I mentioned that we actually have with DHS directly. How are we going to provide that when we're no longer part of DHS? Second, and there's also some elements that need to be in place in order for us to become our agency, like the board language and some of those things. The second wave is really about the coordination that we're doing with DHS and other state agencies. And the third area is, we just want to make sure we don't miss anything. We're going to make sure we're going to go through all of our areas. Our planning here is to go from, started July of last year, all the way through July 1 of this year, where we want to get 47 work groups finalizing their work plans so that we know what we need to implement either in that 6-month period or 12-month period by July 1 of 2025. Then our focus will be, after July 1 of 25, is optimizing and really continuous improvements. It's something that we're going to be talking about in a moment on our Malcolm Baldrige journey that we're doing as an agency. You've got a handout in front of you that describes all of the 47 work groups. On the left side is Wave 1, that I said were the critical components, and you'll see those same categories that we're working with DHS on in separating, as well as talking about the revised language, board language, and just structure and branding. Those are the things that need to be really in place as we move forward, but we've addressed those in moving forward. Wave 2 was so big we broke it into four categories, and we A, B, C, D, and we actually had our incident command team prioritize this for us, so we knew what we had to start with that. And then Wave 3, as I mentioned, are all the other areas that we want to make sure that we're supporting. This is our dashboard that is updated on a weekly basis. You see the key on the right side that everything is in green or blue or black. Green means it's on schedule. No red or yellow right now, which is there's no major issue that we see going forward. Blue means that they've met the deadline of July 1 of getting finalized the action plan, and black means they've now completed it. So what you're seeing here is all of our groups are moving forward 100%, and we got 50% that have now met the deadline for their action plans to be completed and finalized by July 1 of this next year. Within the next 4 months, we anticipate the other 50% will easily make that deadline. I mentioned that the Chapter 61 not only created a new statute, 246C, but it also instructed revisor to make changes and to move things without changing the intent from respective sections into this new statute area, as well as asking DCT to provide us a board language proposal that we're bringing forward as well. So when DCT is going to come forward, we're going to bring forward a proposal that looks at, that really looks at four things that we're going to bring forward. One is a change in the date, just to be in alignment. Two, we're going to be suggesting an agency instead of a department. And this is more just how statutes are written, that departments are headed by commissioners, and you have to revise that or say we're exception to that or put us in as agency. So it's just more of a technical change. The board language. And then DCT creation language. So we're going to need some language that will allow us to work as an independent agency, similar to what DHS or other agencies have already, that we'll go through when those language comes forward. We really took an effort to work with our partners on this. We actually met with we had three listening sessions before we even drafted the language. We presented updates to the tribes, counties, unions, and other stakeholders. We actually presented and asked the governor for a specific special approval to give them a copy of what our language looks like and then give us feedback. Last Friday, we actually had a report out. So they told us what their comments were. We actually responded saying, here's your comments and here's our responses. The big area that we're still working on is the board makeup. There's some questions about that piece, but that'll be something we'll continue to work on as we bring that language forward from the governor. And then I will continue to update those groups. I think it's critical that we're starting this partnership early with these groups, and they're going to be key as we kind of move forward, especially as they're all a part of the continuum of care that we have. The priorities that and kind of next steps for us here, as I mentioned, what's going to come to you is in this session is really the revisor's bill, talking about recodification. It's going to be the DCT bill related to the board and DCT creation. Over the interim, we're going to be finalizing our action plans by July 1. But then we're going to need the governor and through the Secretary of State's process to appoint people to the board. We want to work with them and work with the revisor's office on looking at maybe some terminology. You can imagine the terminology for DCT has been changed over the last 100 years. And there's a lot of old terminology, and we should really have some consistency. It's not something we could get together for this session. So that'd be something we work with them for next session. Next session, of course, would be the cleanup language or anything additional that we need before we became an agency. And then July 1 would be the big date, if that's approved by the legislature, where we become our own agency, as well as the board would begin, and they'd also be appointing and moving forward with bringing that board on. Excuse me. On the next slide, we took the shot at just tentatively what it would take to get the board up and functioning. So we assumed that July 1 would be this date. That's when the board would meet, and they'd create and appoint a CEO at that time. They'd have their bylaws, and they'd begin that process. But in order to do that, you're going to have to back it up 2 months to really get planned and get ready for that first date and that first process. We even have backed it up 4 months earlier than that and said by January, we'd like the board appointed. So they'd have 6 months to learn, understand DCT, maybe even get accredited through a Minnesota Hospital Association, as well as do site visits so that they're up to speed in who DCT is and what we do. That means the governor has to appoint by January, and then, of course, this fall we'd be looking at the selection process for those members. Through the process, it was very interesting feedback we received as we looked at all those 47 groups. One person said, well, you've got a group here on vision, mission, and goals. How can you have a new agency if you don't know what your new vision, mission, and goals is? Excellent question. DCT has an annual process of looking at our strategic plan. It's built on five pillars: quality, service, people, financial, and technology. Through that process, we bring 90 plus of our leaders together to talk about what the direction is, how do we move forward, and we finalize what we're going to be actually working on for areas. This year, we've identified in our strategic plan 11 objectives, 15 strategies, 33 metrics, and we'd be happy to come talk to you about kind of what they are, if that's something the group would like. From those objectives, here are what we're actually focusing on, some of our top priority areas. Staffing. All healthcare systems are dealing with that staffing issue. DCT is really no different in that we're looking at the recruitment and retention of our staffing. Our electronic health record. Again, thank you as a group that you provided us resources to help move forward with an electronic health record. And we're not only looking at that from the terms of the electronic health record, PIP, also telehealth, as well as interoperability over the next 18 months to really enhance that system for our clients, patients, and staff. Again, we're always looking at the fiscal side, like this group does, to make sure that we're advocating the best use of resources. We have internal and external partnerships that we want to continue and extend, as I mentioned earlier. That's something DCT wanted to start early, and we want to really enhance as we move forward. We've got our clinical focus of core four, which is how we're treating with clients and patients and kind of the care for them and the safety for them in that process. And finally, I mentioned the Malcolm Baldrige Award earlier. DCT is in the third stage of our Malcolm Baldrige journey. We did the first stage 2 years ago, got the glowing remarks about that first step, and of course that's the nice first step. Second step, they actually did the site visit, and they're in the process of giving us feedback, and these are really areas that we can improve and move forward with. And our third step will be in 2 years to get an actual evaluation on the federal side from the Malcolm Baldrige as we can move forward. So I know I covered this fairly quickly, Mr. Chair and members, but questions, concerns?
Okay. Thank you so much for the presentation. That was a lot of ground to cover there, and I appreciate your being very quick in the process. One of the things I do understand, is that we're going to be seeing two bills on here. The first one that we're going to end up seeing is what is the revisor's bill that sets up the base work that has to be done. So if we want to make any changes forward, we've got a base to be working off, so everything gets reclassified properly. And the second one, which is the policy bill, is where things will start to change. So the revisor one, if the revisor says this is what we need to do, that's pretty much what it's going to lay out as. And if there's things we want to tweak or change, that'll happen when the policy bill comes out. I just kind of want to lay it out there because it can be a little confusing sometimes. It took me a little bit to wrap my head around, but that's the process that we'll see going forward. And so at this point in time, there may be some questions out there. I'd like to open it up. And I see Representative Edelson, if you'd like to go first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentation. That was very helpful. On slide 12, I want to talk more about the what the board makeup will look like. You had alluded that that's still being decided, and So I want to know about that, but I also want to know how long, remind me, because we work through a lot of legislation here. How long are the appointments? Is it a four-year appointment? Is it 6 years? And then tell me more about the 6 months of training. Is that being developed now? So all three of those issues, if you could cover them. Thank you.
Director Storkamp.
Mr. Chair, representative members. Great questions. This body actually passed language last year so that said that it'll be up to 5 members. And those members with specific areas. DCT, working with our partners, are going to come back and probably make some adjustments to that. The language is not specific about terms, so that'll be something that'll be coming in our policy bill moving forward, looking at 3 or 4 year terms, depending on when people start, staggered terms. We're looking at the different groups that you identified that'd be on there. We're going to probably look at adding somebody who's a professional or a practitioner in the board that wasn't in language, but those are the type of things that we'll bring forward in that bill, in that process. The training, actually, we've already started and have a contract with Minnesota Hospital Association. They actually work extensively with individuals and boards to help set them up and to help train board members as they kind of move forward with things. So we're very excited about that. They've already helped us, and part of our legislation coming forward was built on some of the things that they provided in that recommendation, but that's what we're looking at. We haven't finalized what that 6 months should look at. We're still looking at almost a year out for just that aspect of it, but we are starting about, okay, how do we even form the board? What do we even bring them on board? What type of equipment do you give a board? Because they're gonna be looking at secure information in that process. So those are all the things that we're thinking through right now as we put together that whole board and the board process.
Representative Mendelson.
No follow-up.
Okay. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much for the presentation as well. This is something that is it's a really seismic kind of a shift to our thinking, and I appreciate this. You know, I support the change in this direction, but I know it's going to be a lot of growing pains, and how do we do this? I don't think it's going to save us any money at all, but I think in the long run it's going to give us a better system, and I hope that that's really what our focus is. You mentioned earlier you're starting to meet with your partners out there, again, the unions, the tribal nations, our counties. What are you hearing from them what are we hearing that gives them the most heartburn right now?
Director Storkamp.
Mr. Chair, Representative Baker and members, the heartburn for I think everybody right now is what is the makeup of the board and who should be on it and what's their roles and how should they move forward. So that's some of what they've provided back to us as feedback. Everybody wants to be on the board, but if you take everybody on the board, we won't have practitioners or people with healthcare background. But I will say that from each of the stakeholder groups and the partners here, they do get members that meet the criteria that were laid out. So that should be taken into account in the process. But we are looking at that right now before we finalize the size or who's included in that process because of that feedback we received from our groups.
Representative Baker?
Yeah, I think as we let this sort of absorb itself, and, you know, 5 is a tight number. We may need to revisit that a tiny bit. I'm nervous that the governor is going to be appointing this, whoever the governor is. I think, and again, the term limits, as Representative Edelson was saying, is important to work through. There's a lot to build here. But we have to make sure it's run like a system and a business. That is what we have to do. So again, anxious to see more coming down the road, and happy to still listen to what we're doing, but I hope that the initial board is really, really carefully thought through, and because it's a lot of work to stand up a brand new organization like this. So more to come, I know, so thank you for this.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Baker. Next, Representative Knorr, Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Executive Director Storkamp, I think this is the first time that we're hearing the July 1, 2025. Mm-hmm. And that comes to us as a shock because we wanted to set up the planning to get started so that next legislative session, we have got a plan to be able to say DCT has got its own separate process. So we are able to start tackling the issues going forward. So I think we need to have more conversation on that date specific. And if this chart reflects based on 2025, it may be a little bit not showing clear information, so we may need to have that conversation. I know you'll be testifying on Thursday in the Human Services Finance. We wanted to have more clarity on that, mm-hmm. And also, I just wanted to note that the DCT is more of a safety net in terms of places where other individuals, other hospitals, individuals who have got high need are able to receive the care that they need from different programs. I know we talked about the MIT program for the kids and so many other things. We need to have a bigger picture of where we're headed with DCT. And if you can remind us how many staff members you have in DCT in total.
Director Starkapp.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr, and committee members, I think it's just over 5,000 of the 7,500 in DHS, in approximately that range.
Chair Knorr.
That's significant. It's a huge shift in how we're moving, and this is the bulk of the employees within the DHS system. So we have to be more cognizant of that and to be able to make sure that the workers are protected, that they have got assurance of where we're headed, so they're included. We were more specific in terms of the language who's included in the board, so we'll have more conversation in the coming days. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Knorr. Any other questions? Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would agree that we need to have a lot of conversation about this. This is a huge shift, and I worry about us rushing it too fast to be contemplative about what we're doing and who we're affecting, because we have a system now. It's not perfect, but nothing will be perfect. So, Mr. Chair, I really encourage you, even though we don't really want to meet evenings, we need to make sure that if we're really going to make July 1st a deadline, that we've had a lot of conversation, because this is super important that we're providing those services. Change in legislature is concerning.
Thank you for that feedback, Representative Keel. And I know that Chair Knorr is also very concerned about the same issue. And I would say that this is one of those things that's going to be one of the key issues that we're going to be looking at between our committees going forward. And I appreciate your being open on the time, because this is one of the issues. We want to make sure we've got the right amount of time to make sure we don't miss things, to make sure that we reduce as much as possible things that are getting missed in the process. Any other questions? Representative Baker.
I just had something else, Mr. Chair. Thanks. And I see branding as part of your early stuff. Are we still going to be DC&T, or are we going to come up with something better for the new agency? What are the thoughts to that?
Director Starkapp.
Mr. Chair and Representative Baker, thank you for the leading question. That is a discussion that has been kind of out there. We're looking at DCT as the starting point to move this forward, and that would be something we'd evaluate down the road. To see if there is a better name that would reflect the safety net and the treatment that's being provided for DCT, provided by DCT today. And I will say that as we move forward, I think Representative Keel mentioned it, we have a safety net that we're functioning today. We don't see that significantly changing, because we're going to be reporting to a board instead of DHS. We anticipate that we will revisit that with the board and talk about, is there ways of improving and moving forward. But I want to make sure that people understand our goal is not to change what our safety net is as we have it today, unless this group decides you want us to do more or do different things. That's a whole different thing. But as far as that separation, we don't anticipate a lot changing in our organization.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Thank you so much, Director, for the presentation today. I'm sure that we'll be seeing you more in the future between our committee or Chair Knorr's committee. So we'll look forward to these continued discussions. I want to thank everybody for their attendance today. I want to remind folks that there was a invite that came out from David Zach from the Senate, the staff person for Senator Hoffman over there. There's going to be a joint meeting this afternoon. Dealing with peer recovery. I encourage everyone to attend that. I know a couple others have committee meetings at the same time, but this looks like it'll be a very informative committee meeting. So thank you. And with that, we are adjourned, and we'll see everybody on Monday, February 19th.